This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580, FM 90.9 HD2, and online at will.illinois.edu. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. In the 1920s, flying across the country was a hair-raising experience. As the decades progressed, so did the experience. It was, for a time, glamorous, and the accommodations luxurious. Today there are few amenities, and before boarding, we're probed, screened, and required to take our shoes off. Still, air travel is today the safest way to travel, and it's much more affordable than it was years ago. On the program today, we're going to take a look at the history of commercial aviation. Our guide is Daniel Rust, author of Flying Across America, The Airline Passenger Experience. Listeners, feel free to join the discussion. Join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. And we have a toll-free number. That number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Our guest, Daniel Rust, is Assistant Director of the Center for Transportation Studies at the University of Missouri, St. Louis. Flying Across America, The Airline Passenger Experience is published by the University of Oklahoma Press. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Daniel Rust, welcome. Thank you.
Thank you, Celeste.
As late as 1960, only 10% of American adults had taken even one commercial flight. How many of us today have had the experience?
Anywhere from 82 to 85% of Americans have flown commercially.
That's something to think about, isn't it?
It truly is. We can thank the jet airplane and low fares for that.
Yeah. So how was the experience of flying imagined by the non-flying public years and years and years ago?
It was seen as something very daring, even dangerous. People would think they were taking their own life and limb and at risk to take an aviation, to take an airline flight. And people wouldn't do that. They would say, I would rather not fly. I'll take a train. I'm comfortable with the train travel. This is before automobiles became really common for intercity travel. And people just wouldn't fly. Even insurance companies wouldn't give insurance, life insurance, to people because they would fly until the late 1930s. When life insurance companies would say, okay, it's okay for you to fly and not pay a premium on your life insurance policy.
Yeah. Well, it was pretty risky in the early going. There were a lot of accidents.
Lots of accidents, yes, yes, there were. And a lot of famous people that died in air crashes and makes headlines. Even today, whenever an airliner goes down, it's front page news.
Yeah. Well, Will Rogers comes to mind, also Newt Rockne. Those were a couple of people that perished in air accidents.
That's right. And both of those men were real advocates of air travel and had promoted to the public, saying, you should fly. This is something that you should do. And had both of them, Newt Rockne, a very famous TWA crash, and then Wally Post was flying with Will Rogers in Alaska when they perished.
Yeah. Why were they such fans of air travel? What excited them about it, or what did they see in it that they recommended it so highly?
I think they both saw that it was the future. This is the way that most Americans would travel in decades to come, and wanted to be on the vanguard of that, and believing people should get on board and participate in this new era of transportation.
Yeah. The first person to make a transcontinental journey across America was a fellow by the name of Cal Rogers. The year was 1911. Tell us about him and his accomplishment.
He's an amazing individual. He had quite an illustrious pedigree, and he thought he should do something great to live up to his name. Calbreath Perry Rogers, and he decides to take a flight across the United States, become the very first to fly coast to coast. And he did this to get glory and make himself famous, but also to win a prize. William Randolph Hearst had put up $50,000 for the first person who would fly on an airplane from New York to Los Angeles by way of Chicago. And he said they had to do it by October 1911 and do it within a 30-day time span. And Cal Rogers, he learned to fly in July of 1911, and he begins his odyssey on Long Island in September 17th, 1911. And he's in a little airplane. He's a Wright Brothers aircraft. It's completely exposed to the elements. It's kind of like an ultralight airplane today if you were to take a coffin and go across the country. He makes various hops. He actually makes 69 different little flights across the country. He crashes 15 times. The airplane has so many parts replaced, maybe three parts that were in the airplane. He left New York. We're still in the airplane when he landed in Los Angeles. And he makes this great epic journey across the country. He has a rail entourage with him, a mechanic, spare parts, automobile, some of his family, the press. They're all following his progress across the country. And Cal Rogers makes it. He makes it to Los Angeles 49 days after he leaves. And so, sorry, you don't get the prize, but you get the fame for doing this journey. And folks asked him, well, are you disappointed? And he goes, well, I did it, didn't I? I made the trip. I'm famous. I did what I set out to do. But like so many other aviators of his era, just a few months later, he died in a crash. He was flying along the beach there in Los Angeles, and somehow a bird struck his airplane, and he crashed into the water, and Cal Rogers perished. But it was truly a daring feat, and he broke a lot of bones doing it. It made headlines. It made him famous.
Yeah. I wonder if we could call him the first modern daredevil.
In a way, probably was. Yes.
Yeah. So it took him 49 days to accomplish this. How long did it take at the time to travel by rail across country?
By rail, it would take anywhere from about 4 to 5 days to get across the country.
Mm. And was it possible at this point to drive across the country?
You could. The first person to drive coast to coast was 1903, the same year as the Wright brothers flew. We have to think about the automobile predating the airplane. But really, for long-distance travel, they really grew up together in many cases.
Yeah, and the first person to do this was Horatio Nelson Jackson. He drove from San Francisco to New York. That's another trip I would not have cared to be on, as well as with Mr. Rogers. How long did it take him to drive across country in 1903?
I believe it was a little over 63 days to get coast to coast. And it was harrowing. He was driving a Winton automobile, and he followed the railroad tracks. That's what guided him across the country. Got lost in Wyoming, nearly died. Got out and off from the tracks and got lost. It was an epic journey, and today his car is in the Smithsonian. It's a very important stage in transportation development.
Yeah. How did Rogers navigate?
The same way. Follow the railroad tracks. It's called the Iron Compass. In fact, the early commercial aviators would just follow railroad tracks across the country, and that way you knew you wouldn't get lost as long as you had a railroad track to follow.
Yeah. Well, now we go from Cal Rogers in 1911 to Charles Lindbergh flying across the Atlantic 16 years later. How had aircraft and flying changed in that period of a decade and a half?
Had changed a great deal, mostly due to World War I. The war really spurred development of better engines, better craft. Still, with Lindbergh's aircraft, it's still fabric covered. It's not a metal airplane. It's wood and fabric, much like Cal Rogers' airplane before. But the engine's much more reliable. The Wright Whirlwind engine that powered Lindbergh's aircraft was really the main technical breakthrough that allowed Lindbergh to fly across the ocean, because if he lost engine power, went to the ocean, it was all over for him. And so he had to have a reliable engine. And the engine development was key, the key development, I believe, in that era.
Mm. 1927 was also the year that the post office signed a contract with a man named William Boeing for carrying mail by plane. Had mail been carried by aircraft before?
Yes, it had. It had been carried by balloon, even in the previous century. And then the post office in 1918 began service between Washington, D.C. and New York City. And then they decided to expand the route because, obviously, you're competing with trains. Trains were the predominant mode of carrying mail. And so to make the aviation a viable venture, they decided to go from San Francisco to New York, have a transcontinental route to fly the airmail. And that began 1918, 1920, and then extended up until 1927 when this plane privatized and given over to private industry.
Mm. So government and entrepreneurs both were seeing the value in the future, perhaps, of air transportation for cargo, including mail, and passengers.
That's right. Really, the government and private industry works hand in hand. The private industry would not step in on their own to develop airlines. We really have to thank the federal government and the airmail service for starting the business, getting the business built up that was then handed over to private industry.
Yeah. Now, in 1927, if I have this correct, Boeing Air Transport was flying mail, and it also, at this point, welcomed passengers. What kind of plane did they use, and how many passengers could they take?
Yeah, the plane is a Boeing 40A. The post office used war surplus aircraft, old de Havillands, and they began to get really tired over the years. And Boeing had proposed a new aircraft, the Boeing 40, but the post office rejected it, said it wasn't what they wanted. When this contract came up for the privatization of the transcontinental route, Boeing decides to put a new engine on his Boeing 40 and make a more powerful engine, and proposed to move the mail himself. And this aircraft, the Boeing 40A, had a very large air-cooled engine. It had the pilot still up in an exposed cockpit. It was a biplane, but it had a enclosed cabin area, first for two passengers and then later for four passengers. Little doors, sliding windows, and you climb onto the wing and get into an enclosed cabin. And that was quite revolutionary for Americans. Before then, the airplanes were all open cockpit. If you're a passenger, you're just stuck in the cockpit with the mail and exposed to all the weather and the elements. But the Boeing 40 changed that. People could sit inside an enclosed environment.
So who were the first brave passengers?
A newspaper reporter from Chicago named Jane Eads was the first passenger on Boeing Air Transport. And she flew from Chicago to San Francisco there in the summer of 1927. And she wrote about it. It's a great account in the newspaper of how she was her first airplane flight ever. And early in the morning, still dark, put her inside the airplane and bid her a good flight. And off she goes. These hops across the country, makes different stops. Airplane cruises about 100 miles per hour, and you're always flying close to railroad tracks, close to the ground. And she, it gets warm, gets very warm in the cabin later in the day, and she actually changes clothes while inside the airplane.
Hmm.
And the pilot doesn't know she does this, but she gets very warm, and the window's open, but still too warm, no air conditioning at this point. And she arrives in San Francisco and is hailed as a great pioneering hero for making this trip.
It's interesting to me that women figure so prominently in the story.
Yes, female passengers were quite daring, but it's almost a publicity thing, too, trying to get women more actively involved in American life, in the public life. And it's quite liberating for women to be part of this adventure of air travel. And the airlines took note of that, trying to convince women that it was something they should do. And if women could be convinced that it was okay to fly, more than likely the husbands would come along, too, and begin to use air travel.
Yeah. When did we begin to see airlines use publicity photos and pamphlets and drawings and the like to get people to become interested in flying?
Right from the earliest days, the airlines are trying to convince people to get on board. And the way to do that would be through posters or schedules they would publish, much like the railroads would do. It really mirrors the railroads in their advertising campaigns, trying to convince people to fly. And they say It's elegant. It's, you know, a modern thing to do. You'll have a nice view from the sky of the ground. That's novel. It's different. You'll be very fast, swift transportation, and you should participate in this. And so with a schedule and nice little drawings or pictures alongside, and also posters and advertised in magazines and newspapers.
Yeah. There's a photograph that you've included, one of many in the book, that is of a Varney Airlines, which was part of United Airlines, a pilot and a woman, a young woman, very handsome young woman and a very handsome young man, and she is handing the pilot an airmail letter. And this is a Boeing 40B. And it looks, you know, it makes it look so attractive.
Yes, it does. It does. It's and people, when they took these flights, would dress up. This is a, you know, opportunity of a lifetime to participate in this. And it was seen as something very glamorous. The popular press didn't want to focus much on air sickness, on the people who were losing their lunch over the mountains, or how loud it was in these airplanes. Literally deafening. Had to have cotton for the ears and then have chewing gum to help pop your ears as the altitude changed. But it was not a pleasant way to travel.
No.
Not at all.
No.
But it was portrayed as very glamorous.
Yeah. And in this photo, you do get an idea of how difficult, at least, it is to climb into the passenger compartment on this Boeing 40B, which could carry four passengers. Because you have to, as you mentioned, you have to climb up over the wing. So how did women make that get in there in a dress or in a skirt?
Yes, yes. It would. There'd be mobile stairs brought up to the aircraft, and they climb these stairs, step out onto the wing, and then the door is not very tall. And so literally the female would have to kind of bend over and back into the seat of the airplane, trying to maintain modesty while doing all of this. But yeah, it was wasn't like today, going to jetway and just walk right into aircraft.
Yeah.
These are very small environments to squeeze into.
Yeah. You've drawn on the accounts of early transcontinental passengers for this book. What overall picture do they give us of what the experience was like, air sickness and the thrill of it and all of it all together?
Right. The first-hand accounts that I use in the book, I was pretty careful about what I chose, the kinds of articles. I wanted to be published and published nationally, and that it would be published close to the date of travel, not decades later looking back and saying, oh, I was part of that. It was these accounts were quite fresh, and it was a way to inform people, inform the public about what flying was really like. And so many of these people are journalists that take these trips and write about it. Some are just kind of common people that would submit these articles and get them published. Some are very famous, like Will Rogers and others who would get their accounts published. And the portrait they paint is that it is exciting, that it is a thrill to take these flights. Many of them, some common themes would be they look down at the ground and try to describe what they see. They say people are like ants, and they see little cars, and we see a whole new perspective on our country. That was a real common theme throughout these early first-hand accounts. The speed, the rush of travel, the takeoff, breathtaking. They say, you know, grip the handrest on my seat and just hang on as the airplane leaps into the sky. And then it's like, oh, this isn't so bad. And then they begin to relax and try to not really talk with people because it's too loud. The early airliners just pantomime with each other. Many of these airliners, particularly the Ford Tri-Motor, some of those in the early to mid-1930s, would have a speedometer, an altimeter, and a clock at the very front of the cabin. And the people would watch these very intently. How high are we? How fast are we going? And what time is it? And it was... many of these accounts say they would point when it got interesting. Oh, we're at 10,000 feet, and they'd point at the altimeter to the other passengers. And, oh, yes, it's exciting. But still, when they landed, it took a while to get hearing back, just the loud ringing in the ears. About 115 decibels would be the sound in most early aircraft. It's like having a chainsaw next to your ear for hours on end.
Yeah. Not so good.
No.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon is Daniel Rust. He's an assistant director. He is the assistant director of the Center for Transportation Studies at the University of Missouri, St. Louis. And he's the author of Flying Across America, The Airline Passenger Experience. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with questions, comments, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, toll-free, 800-222-9455, 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Boy, among the changes we've seen is the amount of interaction between passenger and pilot.
That's correct. Yes, the early passengers would be right there with the pilot. They would be in very close proximity to each other. The pilot sometimes share his lunch with the passenger, and it was pretty cozy. And usually these pilots were famous. They had been airmail pilots. They were well known in the press. And some of these early passengers say, oh, you know, tonight I had Ham Lee as my pilot. And, wow, it's so great to meet him finally. I've heard so much about him. And to finally shake his hand was a real honor and a thrill. And as the years go by, you have larger aircraft, more and more people in the airplane. A pilot still would walk through the cabin, talk to people, shake hands, and be seen. But then, of course, as we've come into most recent time, the captain is more of just a voice. We hear a voice over the intercom, and that's about the extent of the interaction until you leave the airplane and maybe say hi to the captain on the way out. But it's a very different interaction between pilot and passenger.
Yeah. Let's take a call from the listener now. Caller, waiting for us in Champaign on line one. Hi.
Hello.
Hi.
I was wondering, I'd like to recommend, first off, they're hard to find. I just was looking on Amazon.com, a book called Diamonds in the Sky. There was a companion series of the BBC about 25 years ago that was an excellent program to watch. And as I recall from that and other things I've seen, I was wondering if you could comment upon two aircraft in particular that made commercial airline travel a great success, the first being the DC-3, which I must say was the first aircraft I ever rode on way back when, in Ozark Airlines back in the 60s, and then later the Boeing 707. As I understand it, those two aircraft, one could make an argument, truly made mass transportation in the air, first off, safe. In both cases, the DC-3 was a remarkably safe plane for its time, and still is. And the 707 made it fast and affordable, and so on and so forth. If you would comment then, please. Thank you.
Okay, right. Thanks for the call.
You're absolutely correct. I would look at the DC-3 and the Boeing 707 as really the two key aircraft that do make commercial air travel safe and make it something that folks want to do. The DC-3, of course, built by Douglas Aircraft Company, and it carried 21 passengers. It had two engines. It was all metal, made of all metal aircraft, and had retractable landing gear. It had more soundproofing in it. You actually talk to each other inside the aircraft. Hot meals served for the first time on DC-3s. And the airlines, as soon as they get these in the mid-1930s, it becomes the standard. Everybody wants a DC-3. And by 1939, 1940, about 80% of all passengers in America fly on DC-3s. DC-3 swept every aircraft before it, kind of in the dustbin of history, and it became the standard. And the 707 did really the same thing. The jetliner changed the experience so radically. The British had the first jet aircraft for commercial service, the Comet, the de Havilland Comet. They had some accidents, some crashes with the Comet. And the U.S. learned from that. Boeing's at 707, and then the Douglas DC-8. These come into use in the United States by 1959, and people would take a jet flight and say, wow, why didn't we do this before? This is fantastic. It's pretty quiet in here. It's very smooth. It's very fast, almost double the speed of previous airliners, and it carries large numbers of people. The Boeing 707 could carry nearly 200 people. And it seems a huge airplane for its time. And it really made mass travel possible and pleasant.
Mm. The first airline trip I took was aboard a Boeing 747, which was an amazing experience. It was in the 70s, and I was a teenager. Great experience. And boy, it seemed huge. That plane seemed huge to me.
Yeah, the 747 was huge. It was just a gigantic aircraft for its time. Came into service by 1970, 71, with the domestic airlines. And it could carry 30 to 500 people, depends on how it was configured, about 350 to 500 people. And it was just gigantic. People have never seen anything like this before. It has been the largest commercial plane until the Airbus A380, which is now in service on international routes.
I wonder how many people today who have recently made their first trip can recall what plane they've flown on.
That's a good question. We don't really talk about types of aircraft to passengers anymore. You just go to the gate and get on the airplane. And people really don't pay a whole lot of attention to who makes the airplane or what type it is. In my experience lately, it's an airplane. I just get on and I go.
Yeah. Well, when I made my first trip, it was before a spate of hijackings in the 70s, and it was before deregulation, and it was still pretty pricey to fly. And the experience was very pleasant. One of the things I remember is that you could listen to music in flight. I don't know when that innovation came along. Music and movies, when did they arrive on air flights?
That's really a post-World War II phenomenon. Mm-hmm. The first movie, 1961, TWA had the first movie system installed in a jetliner. It was a Boeing 707, and the first movie was called By Love Possessed, a Lana Turner film. It took off, really. The people loved having the movie in flight. There was a big screen at the front of the aircraft that projector projected the image onto it. And then you had headsets to listen to the sound on the system. Other competing systems came along. American Airlines and others adopted this very quickly because passengers liked this so much to have an in-flight movie. Because it's ironic that as time goes on, from these early passengers who talk about the ground perception, oh, wow, we're moving so quickly, and look at the beautiful scenery. And it by the jet age, we're at 35, 40,000 feet. You feel like you're just sitting. Mm-hmm. Ground isn't moving, your perception, and people get bored. They say it's boring. It's just smooth flying, nothing to do up here. I have a magazine, a map, but nothing much to do. And so the movie was something that would really appeal to people as they flew on the jetliners.
Yeah, and while we're here on the subject of amenities on board, tell us about how the food service on planes, how it evolved. When Will Rogers made his cross-country flight in 1928, it was a box lunch, and his wife Betty was concerned about that he'd have enough to eat, so she packed quite a picnic for him. But maybe you tell us a little bit about airline food over the decades.
Certainly, the airlines thought they had to serve food. And unlike the trains, where you rode a train, they would charge you for each meal. With airlines, from the earliest days, they'd say it's complimentary. It comes with the flight. It's part of your fare to get some food. Boxed lunches were the most common food offered. It'd be usually some chicken sandwich, some kind of cold sandwich, and maybe an apple, some lemonade to go with it, something light, because and this is a bumpy flight, and they want to have a lot of heavy food because people are going to probably get sick. And so it was something more light in the stomach. Fresh strawberries, fresh fruit, very popular. And the aircraft didn't have the galley for fixing hot food or keeping food hot. They would just serve cold food until the DC-3 in the mid-1930s. And then you can serve meals pre-made on the ground and then brought into the aircraft and then served to the people that would still be warm. And this would evolve then into something very, very elegant. They would begin to use china and regular silverware, tablecloths, and serving quite a nice meal, just like you'd have on a train. That was their standard for the airlines. And people like this. I mean, you actually have steak dinners, baked potatoes, dinner rolls, the green beans, the whole spread that would be given to people. And people came to expect that. That was just common. Really until about deregulation, when the airlines said, well, we're losing money by serving all this fine food.
Yeah.
Let's cut back on that. Folks will still fly anyway, whether we serve them all this food or not.
Yeah. Let's take another call, a listener in Marseilles. Line 4, hi.
Hi. This is interesting. I love traveling. It has been a while. But I took a trip to Australia, flew out of Los Angeles. And, you know, even though it was 1998, what blew my mind was that all the way the 8,200 miles from Los Angeles to Sydney was flown in 13 and a half hours in a 747-400. And I when I looked at the screen ahead of me, and they sort of had those gauges up there by the electronic projections of the time, the position over the Pacific where the airplane was, and your altitude, which was 45,000 feet, and then they'd have it in meters as well. And then the temperature was minus 50. And that blew my mind. And I just watched that screen where the airplane, we crossed the equator. I'd never crossed the equator before. And then parenthetically, I'd like to add, on the way home, I took the milk run from New Zealand. It was a trip to both countries, and we stopped in Rarotonga in the middle of the night. It's just this little tiny island out in the middle of no place, and I was amazed they could find it. I even took pictures of the airplane, which I'd never done in my life, flying from, say, Chicago to, you know, Seattle or something, and it was a 747-400. And then we stopped in Hawaii, and the security was so lax that I didn't even clear customs, and we had to wait 2 hours to get to Los Angeles before the next plane would go or we'd refuel. And I just walked outside, and this steward, this air steward, he says, "Where do you think you're doing?" I says, "I'm going out to get some fresh air." And he says, "Well, you haven't cleared customs." I says, "I don't care. I'm going outside." And nobody even cared. You know, this is pre-9/11. I suppose now you wouldn't just be able to get off a plane and walk out of the airport without getting inspected or arrested or something. And this is only 1998, you know, 11 years ago. I just wondered if you had any comments about that, those several points I made.
Certainly.
I'll hang up and listen.
Okay, thanks for the call.
Yeah, the security issue has certainly changed post-9/11. We had all the checkpoints in place. We had scanned the checked baggage. All that was in place. But it would get kind of lax. I had personal stories of getting through security and thinking, oops, I forgot to, you know, leave this at home, but it's still in my pocket or something, and just get through quite easily. And post 9/11, we'd hope that it all would be much safer. And as Celeste mentioned at the start of the program, you know, you have to take your shoes off, you have to, you know, put all your bags, laptop, everything through the scanner, and it's much more tight security. And for good reason, with all the hijackings and especially the 9/11 event. And as you mentioned, the 747-400, this is really the workhorse of the international travel at this date. And the 747, say it's been around for almost 40 years now, and it's been just an amazing vehicle for moving people who otherwise wouldn't go international. They just couldn't afford it. 747 has really opened the world to so many people who before just couldn't take a flight.
Our guest this afternoon, Daniel Rust, author of Flying Across America, The Airline Passenger Experience. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments, stories, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, toll-free 800-222-9455. Let's take another call, a listener in Champaign, line 1. Hi.
Hello.
Hello.
I hope you will accept one negative view of the airlines. I used to love to fly until about 30 years ago, but today I have virtually no liking for the Wright brothers' folly at all. One has to go through these concentration camps that they call airports. A timetable on an airline means nothing. You get shipped like eggs in a crate. The food is just wretched. Everything about it is wretched. And so what accounts for this, I don't know. But I'm afraid I'm a disbeliever in airline travel as it is today, and I wish they could do something.
Well, I think that you're not alone in feeling those the things about flight today. Daniel Rust, you want to comment?
Yes, as you said, he is not alone at all with this sentiment. I used to fly fairly often. I don't like too much anymore simply because of all of what he just mentioned. You feel like you're just being inspected all the time, and it's the real fun of travel, I think, has evaporated to a large measure. It's kind of like taking a city bus, but with all the security added on to it. And getting through airports, it's a place you've passed through but never really been to. You just get to the airport, just get on the airplane, get to where you're going, and not wanting to really enjoy the journey.
Yeah.
Journey is just a means of getting somewhere, not something to be relished or enjoyed by any means.
In 2000, my mother and I flew from Dallas-Fort Worth to Milwaukee. I believe the airline was Midwest Airlines, and it was wonderful. And we had such a good experience and such a good time. In fact, when they brought the food out for us, my mother said, "Is this a dream?" Because we had silverware and plates. It wasn't a feast, but it was very nice.
Right. Midwest is a great, great experience. And their cookies. The cookies are just wonderful.
Yeah.
And, they just got bought out. These lines come along. These airlines have a whole new product to kind of bring back some romance of flying. And it's just hard to make it. It comes down to economics. The airline business is not a good way to make money. I've heard, in fact, if you stacked up all the profits of the airlines have made since they started 1920s till today, it'd be a negative. Actually, the total profit loss is very much on the loss side, and it's not a good way to make money.
Yeah, I wonder if there would be any way to have a niche airline like Midwest, where you could, maybe it wasn't luxurious, maybe it's not glamorous, but it's a lot more comfortable. Maybe we just don't want to pay the price for that as passengers.
I think that's really what it comes down to is the price. I mean, so why does Southwest succeed and others don't? Just jam as many folks as you can in the seats. Mm-hmm. And even Southwest, I once heard the Herb Kellerer, the one of the founders of Southwest, said that on average about two seats in every airliner are the profit. And that's 120-some seats on a plane. And so it's a very slim margin to make a profit. Mm-hmm. And if you start adding amenities, start adding more leg room, taking seats like American Airlines did around the year 2000, suddenly your profit evaporates, what was left as a profit. And it's just a very, very difficult market to make a profit. Although there are some niche airlines, and one just starting up caters just to pets. It's going to fly just pets, cats, dogs, and the like. And we'll see if they make it or not.
Mm.
But there are folks, entrepreneurs, who would adventure to try something new.
Okay. Let's go take some more calls. Next, we go to a listener in Indiana on a cell phone line 4. Hi.
Hi. Actually, a question and then an observation, wondering about a comment, and I'll hang up afterwards. Question, you talked about the first car to go transcontinental in the Smithsonian. I know Lindbergh's placed there, but what about the first plane that went transcontinental? Did that survive, and if so, where is it? And then the observation, you were talking about airlines and, I guess, the service. And I know that railroads, they tended to be African-American, and yet, at least my observation of watching early movies and, observation of earlier flying, they tended to be white. And I was wondering if that was deliberate on the part of the airline. And I will hang up.
Okay, good questions.
Yeah, the Vin Fizz, Cal Rogers airplane, I believe is in the Smithsonian still. It's an icon of its era. Speaking of race and the airlines, I deal with that in the book, where many folks don't talk about race and air travel. The one of the curators of the Smithsonian, Ron Davies, that was kind of starting something new here, talking about this issue, because it really was the domain of whites. For several reasons. One was just economics. Go back to the early days of air travel, and people of color, by and large, would have the means to fly and pay these exorbitant amounts that would be at the time to fly. And also just discrimination. It wasn't official discrimination on the airlines, but there are accounts, like Jackie Robinson, for instance. I mentioned him in the book, and how he He goes to his first spring training camp, flying from Los Angeles, trying to get to Pensacola and then on to Daytona Beach, Florida. And he never experienced Jim Crow laws or any of that kind of discrimination. And in New Orleans, he's bumped off the flight for no explanation, just said, "You're off," and realized that it's because of his race. And they had to have a certain number of seats between the races on airplanes. It was an official thing or unofficial on many of the airlines that would fly into the Deep South. And so they didn't have those seats available to keep open. They just bump off the person of color and make them fly a different time. Or Jackie Robinson took a bus, sat in the back of a Greyhound bus all the way to his training camp then. And deregulation, and even before, you would have this color line broken through. Really, the civil rights movement would desegregate the airports and the airlines as well. So by the late 1960s, it really wasn't that much of an issue.
Yeah. What about employment opportunities? The caller mentioned the train, and my experience has always been as a train passenger that car attendants, waiters, bartenders are often people of color.
That's correct. On the railroads, it was the Pullman porters, and they're exclusively of color. That was a very proud domain for people of color, and lots of books written about them and the rising of a black middle class out of that profession. The airlines, the early days, they didn't have anybody on board to help serve the people. That the co-pilot would take care of the passengers, and it was Boeing again, Boeing Air Transport, where they decided they want to have a female nurse on board to help calm passenger nerves, to help serve, and just the presence of a young female on board to help everybody just kind of relax and not be so uptight on the airplane. And so the first stewardess, Helen Church, in 1930, begins to serve on United Airlines. And this becomes a great success. They're called hostesses on TWA, but stewardess was just an icon of air travel. Then after the Civil Rights Act, 1964, men would be hired then, so the term flight attendant would come into existence. But it really wasn't a domain of, and even the late 1950s before the first African-American stewardess even be hired as Mohawk Airlines. Mm. So it was really a domain of white women before then.
Let's take another call. Listener in Urbana on line two. Hi.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. And also, I wanted to say that I saw a review of your book in a magazine a couple of weeks ago, and it really sounded interesting, and so I put it on my birthday wish list for later this month. So I'm looking forward to actually seeing a copy. I just wanted to mention one thing. There's maybe of interest to people locally. There is a small plaque along a county road southwest of Bloomington with a site where Charles Lindbergh crashed one time, not fatally, obviously, but when he was flying the airmail routes. And so southwest of near the little town of Sanford, Illinois, that there is a plaque along a roadside marking the site where Lindbergh crashed in the field, and probably not many people know that. You were also mentioning, Celeste, was about the first flights. I took mine on a Convair 240, if you remember what those are, and I have written on it. It's kind of like a DC-3, I guess. Interesting. I have been on DC-3s. And we were talking about food service, and I wanted a couple of comments about that. One was, you know, airlines used to reflect, international airlines really reflected their country. They do a little bit today, but not to the extent. And I remember one time back in the 60s, I guess it was, when I was flying on Alitalia Airlines from Lima, Peru to Caracas, Venezuela, of all places, on a plane eventually back to Rome. But we were in Lima, and you know, standing at the ticket counter, no one was there. The plane landed. All these Italians came running out of the plane, took our tickets. We got on board, and the pilot was, you know, like a 707, but he thought he was flying a Ferrari. And so we took off from Lima, and we went, you know, really fast, and of course, to get over the Andes, but he's Italian. And so we didn't really, like, go over the Andes. We went through the Andes, you know, flying around through. It was wonderful. I liked that. And we had this most wonderful, you know, typical Italian food while flying over the Andes and then across the Amazon basin. And the food was just wonderful, and it's really changed drastically on the quality of even international flights these days. Mm-hmm. Anyway, just wanted to make those comments, and I'll hang up, and if you have any responses, that'd be fine. Thank you.
Okay, we wish you a happy birthday later this month. Okay, Daniel Rust.
Yes, Charles Lindbergh crashed more than once. He was a member called the Caterpillar Club. He had used his parachute, and this is flying airmail between Chicago and St. Louis. And he got in trouble over Illinois and would have to jump out of his airplane. An airplane crashed, and he would land with his parachute and then get the mail carried on. In fact, it got so bad, he crashed more than once, and they considered just firing him because of his piloting skills, that he wasn't up to it. But it was over Illinois while he's flying that he got the idea to fly to Paris from New York.
Very interesting. And any comments on the on international flights and airlines that are foreign owned and the experience there? And maybe we could ask you to of all the airlines in the world, what today is the finest?
Probably the finest for service would be Singapore Airlines. Mm. Just about luxury. It's a fantastic way to fly. They have the new Airbus A380s and lots of amenities on board. And just the service is always rates top-notch in the world. The caller is right that many of these airlines that would kind of carry the flag for their country would have more ethnic kinds of foods and really reflect their own nationality. And you see, it's not going away. They really do. From British Airways and others who would be more just international in flavor now in what they do. And again, it's a matter of economics. They have been to cut back on so many things that before were just part of the experience and now they're perks or gone altogether. Mm.
There we've got to leave it. We're out of time. Daniel Rust, thank you very much for talking with us this afternoon.
Thank you.
Daniel Rust is the author of Flying Across America, The Airline Passenger Experience. The book is published by the University of Oklahoma Press.